There's no one clear, coherent strategy that basically is always on day in, day out. Things change and they evolve. For example, I think we basically assessed that the risk level macro-wise is much higher in the next 3-4 months, then despite the fact that we see many good long-term opportunities, we need to take that into consideration and protect the portfolio.
This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Goldrock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice. Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast. My name is Darren Rockman, and I am a partner at Goldrock Capital, the 22-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth families in Israel and around the world. And today on the podcast, Ron Senator. Hi, Ron.
Hi, nice to see you. Hi, Darren.
Good to see you too, Ron. Ron in Tel Aviv. Co-founded Sphera Funds Management back in 2004. He's a portfolio manager there, making investment decisions on a range of securities. Prior to Sphera, Ron was the head of JP Morgan Chase in Israel. He was also JP Morgan in New York at SG Cowen. He has a BA in economics from Bar-Ilan University and an MBA from Yale. And what you probably missed in all that is that he's also one of the pioneers of Israel's hedge fund industry. And so we want to talk a little bit about hedge funds, markets, investments with Ron, who's, as you're going to find out, a really smart investor. So Ron, you founded Sphera, as I said, back in 2004, and it was the first Israeli hedge fund, as far as I know. How has that landscape changed over those 18 years?
Okay. First of all, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here. 2004 sounds like the days where we hardly had cars or
horses and carriages.
Black and white TVs.
Yes, but we were still using fax machines in those days.
You're probably correct by indicating that we were the pioneers of the hedge fund industry in Israel. We really started as a single hedge fund in the marketplace here. Since then, obviously, things have developed and evolved tremendously. And this is a well-developed marketplace now. We have probably close to, 100 active hedge funds around. And most of them are long-short equities or equities-centric investment strategies. The industry itself or the marketplace is quite constrained from a liquidity perspective. You can't expect to have hundreds and hundreds of hedge funds or compare it to or benchmark it against US sort of parameters. But I think what it has done is that it actually helped to advance the Israeli capital market to a great degree. From a liquidity perspective, from, I would say, market depth in terms of number of issues, float, almost, it's a much more active marketplace today than it was, obviously, 10, 15 years ago.
And you mentioned the size of the market. Have you seen over that period of time the size of the market increase, the number of opportunities which you can exploit in the world of Israeli equities?
Yes, clearly, yes. But probably it's fair to say that we define the Israeli marketplace as not only domestically listed stocks here, but also we look at some of our companies that are traded overseas, primarily US, and some of them are in Europe. Most of them basically are on the tech side. And if you look at that particular segment of our universe, this has really multiplied by a number of factors over the past few years. Even despite the market corrections or the sell-off that we're experiencing this year, still, it's a completely different marketplace from size, number of companies, and almost any matrix that you want to look at.
Okay, let's take a step back because I think we've maybe rushed ahead. Describe Sphera's investment strategy, your philosophy, and maybe tell us how that's changed over the period in which you've been operating.
It hasn't changed that much from a focus and from a sort of strategy perspective. What it has done is really evolved to cover more companies, more segments, more industries, obviously, as markets evolve. there have been much more sort of opportunities. Here in Israel, I think that there are a lot of, I would say, real estate, renewable energy, many new issues in the marketplace. And it's a fairly diversified, broad marketplace. There are about 300-400, I would say, investable companies.
Israeli listed equities.
Yeah, I'm referring to equities. And when I say investable, they qualify from a sort of a minimum, I would say, float perspective, and also allow us to build a position and also to trade it over time. And that refers to the sort of the Israeli listed stocks, but on the US and European listed stocks, the size of the universe has again grown dramatically over the past few years.
And will you invest in any US or European stock, or are there some limitations? Because you'll invest in anything in Israel, I assume.
We basically define our strategy as Israeli related focus. And that basically, that means that, again, it's a fine line, or there's no clear, hard rule what company is considered Israeli and what is not. But if a company has a presence here or they have some Israeli roots, that clearly falls into that category. But even if not, we don't want to limit ourselves only to that part of the definition. So given that most of the sectors, the international sectors, international industries that we are covering are global, because if an Israeli company is basically exporting its products or services overseas, then obviously they're targeting global markets.
Sure.
In that sense, then we are covering the global marketplace itself. So we are benchmarking against the peers. Again, what are the sort of the driving competitors and dynamics, sort of business trends and everything that you might think of that allows us to conduct an intelligent analysis. A lot of the companies that we are targeting, that we are looking at, are adjacent to our Israeli companies.
Okay. So a competitor of that just happens to be a US company or a European company. So let's just take that for a second, because it's actually an interesting point. How different is it when you're investing in a company listed on the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange versus a company listed in London or in New York? Is there a different set of parameters? Are there different considerations, or is it basically the same?
Business is a business. So I think the basic fundamental variables are the same. Accounting, balance sheet, the competitive advantages, the moat of the business. What is different is that being based in Tel Aviv is probably less constrained than I was 5 or 10 years ago, given the way that we conduct this conversation, or the intensity of us getting on a plane, the number of times we need to get on a plane to see other companies or to participate in a conference is lower today than what it was 5 or 10 years ago. And because I think technology allows us to be much more connected and bridge the gap. But still, within domestic sectors, there's always some sort of an edge or an ability to be more plugged into the market and understand some of the dynamics.
Right.
From a business perspective, but not only from a business perspective, also from a commercial, from a flow perspective. Who is trading the stock? Who are the holders? Why are they selling? Right. Who is trading? A variety of factors that are intangible that help us to understand the story or understand the situation, the circumstance, in a more granular way when it refers to some of the domestic sectors. For example, banks or insurance companies or some of the local real estate. There's always obviously some information flow that it's easier to obtain when you're on the ground here.
Got it. Okay. So given that it's a little easier for you guys to be investing in Israel, that you do invest obviously both, let's just talk about something you touched on before, which is the depth of the Israeli market. So the Israeli Stock Exchange, if I've got this right, is total market cap is about $250 billion, which by international comparisons is about two-thirds of the size of the Belgium stock market. And I don't think anybody I know has ever invested in the Belgium stock market, at least not intentionally. All of the hedge funds, those 100 hedge funds, most of them trading equities, as you said, on a long-short basis. How has that competitive dynamic affected Sphera?
It clearly defines probably the potential cap of the strategy. We're not aspiring, we're not aiming to increase the size of the fund to a $10 billion fund because we understand the limitations. That's one aspect. Two, again, I'm also bringing back to the equation the international part of the strategy, because if you look at the sort of the tech components, the US listed tech components of our strategy, they're probably adding another at least 100 plus billion dollars to the total sort of investable universe. Then you go to basically to review some of the other adjacent companies. So I give you a very simple example just to crystallize the argument here. For example, we have a fairly dedicated granular effort on the cyber front, right? We basically are spending a lot of time analyzing and understanding the cyber marketplace and some of the leading competitors and some of the trends in the marketplace. Also, by the way, including some of the private companies as they refer or how are they impacting or how are they basically driving some of the public companies. There are a number of Israeli companies, obviously, on the cyber front, but there are also other international companies. So is Palo Alto Networks an Israeli-related company? Is it,
right.
If you look at the zip code or some of the right. other attributes, it's probably a Palo Alto company.
Right.
It clearly belongs to what we see as the core group of the companies that we at least aspire to develop a fairly granular base of knowledge.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about what's happened this year. So obviously 2022 has looked very different to last year and really the year before. And we've seen two things. There's obviously been a significant trade down in values. And at the same time, a lot of volatility. And we're recording this on the 18th of October. And the last week has been incredibly volatile, even by the standards of equity markets. Is that an opportunity for you guys? Is that a challenge for you guys? How does it affect your business?
It's very challenging. I'm not going to sit here and tell you this is just basically just an opportunity. It's a challenge because what we need to do is, on the one hand, we are long-term or mid-term investors, and we're obviously putting a lot of effort into identifying some of the quality long-term business models that are going to be winners over the long haul. On the other hand, we need to manage the month-to-month volatility or the day-to-day volatility. And that basically entails a lot of challenges and some short-term decisions. So it's all about basically balancing between some of the short-term pains and some of the risk management steps that we need to apply to the portfolio and still basically trying to ensure that we are positioned when the market when and not if, but when and to what degree when the market recovers. So it's sort of a minefield, to be honest.
Does that mean you're holding more cash than you would otherwise? Does that mean that you're just balancing your positions with shorts on the other side so that you're more neutral to the market?
That typically means that we apply more hedging and more protection to the portfolio, at least attempting not to sell the stocks that we basically view as very favorable and long-term winners.
Okay. And so let's maybe talk about, you know, one or two of the investment opportunities that, you know, you're focused on today, given, you know, the challenges and the difficulties of navigating really tricky macro environment. Where do you see, you know, value over that medium term that you're talking about, which I assume to you means a couple of years?
So again, without getting into specific names, I can point maybe to segments.
Yeah.
Or some certain fields that we see as relatively attractive. Obviously, the number one group is technology, because technology has always been somewhat of a focus for us in terms of resources and a lot of work putting into that field and identifying some of the really sustainable, sort of consistent winners over time. And these companies were priced for perfection during 2021. And towards the end of last year, they started to really suffer. And basically, there was a massive sell-off that spilled in entire groups of stocks, quality or lesser quality, by 40, 50, 60, and 80%. So
the baby in the bathwater.
The baby in the bathwater, clearly, that's a very applicable analogy these days. Now, that's not to say that some of these good businesses are not going to miss a quarter or adjust their guidance if macro conditions are going to further deteriorate. But still, you got to make that distinction between, okay, what's a broken story and what was just riding on macro tailwinds or COVID-related stimulus, and what's really holding its own and sustainably going to grow long-term. Again, we see businesses that are, I have two examples on my desk. One of them is a stock that is down 80%, and they have close to 50% of the market cap in cash already. It's not a cash-burning story. It's not a cash-burning business, but still, it really fell out of favor. They had to adjust guidance one quarter, and they're basically at least aiming to get back to growth trajectory from the second half of this year already. And it's a dilemma because 2-3 years out, I'm pretty certain, as certain as we can be,
yeah,
at least we're in the forecasting business, that things will be okay, more than okay. What I can't be 100% sure is whether fourth quarter or first quarter 23 is going to be as solid as I think it should be. And this is a dilemma. So I think we're solving that dilemma with basically sizing, appropriate proportional sizing of these positions. We're not betting the farm on one particular stock or another, but we need to basically take a bet here. We need to basically decide whether we're going for it or we're not.
Okay. So first example, quality tech businesses that may have been unfairly punished in the market drawdown that's happened this year. What's another example of a sector?
No, but also, so maybe again to clarify what you just said, is that I think COVID basically has, in a way, impacted the growth trajectory of many, if not most, companies within the tech landscape in a way that it basically pulled forward a lot of their future growth. And basically this pace of growth is apparently not sustainable, and they need to normalize. And as part of this normalization, the market is implying or is pricing these stocks as broken stories or as broken business models, right? So this normalization phase is somewhat essential. On the other hand, still no equilibrium in terms of pricing, in terms of multiples. So that's one example. Another example, some value stocks. You're even looking at the banking industry in Israel, where they're clearly macro sensitive.
Yeah.
But in a way, they are benefiting from almost like perfect conditions. This is as sweet as they can
aspire. Pay nothing on deposits and earn lots of money on lending.
And you obviously benefit from day one from every interest rate increase or from every 20, 30 basis points of inflation. Everything flows straight to the bottom line.
Yeah.
No additional costs. And obviously this is a picture perfect here because we are not seeing yet any deterioration in credit cycle. That brings me to the point where the domestic economy is actually in a fairly robust shape. Things are looking pretty good here, macro-wise, not to say that we're not going to be impacted from any spillover effects from Europe or US, we will. But I think the basic foundation of the economy is solid, and banks are much better capitalized today than they were in the last financial crisis.
Yeah.
And they cut costs, their expenses are much more, they're much more rationalized in terms of their margin structure and expense trends.
Plus the shekels working in exporters' favor.
Yeah, and they haven't gone into any international adventures, which were very painful.
Last time, yeah.
Like last time. So I think it's a pretty decent place to not only hide, but also generate pretty attractive return profile. So this is another example.
Okay. I'm going to finish up with one sort of general question. For an investor looking to invest in the Israeli equity market, if you brought it down to two choices, one is just buy the ETF, simple, stupid, passive instrument, you know, buy the Tel Aviv index versus a hedge fund strategy, which is going to be long short. As a way of getting exposure, there are obviously advantages and disadvantages to both. How do you look at those as alternatives?
You know that I'm biased, right? So
of course you're biased. That's why I asked you.
Yeah. I think the ETF, it's clearly an alternative. It's a low-cost alternative from a nominal perspective. But still, it has a lot of drawbacks, especially in the Israeli marketplace, because there are certain stocks that have very high weightings in the index, and you not necessarily want to own these businesses. Right. And the rate of change in the weightings of the index is not that high. For example, Teva, obviously, it's a fairly large cap international company, and it basically has almost disproportionate weight in the Israeli index. It used to be double what it is now, but right. still, it's about 5%.
Right.
And I'm not sure you want to own 5% of your portfolio in Teva. You might want, but if you don't, then that basically penalizes you. Now, I think in different indices, I would say more dynamic indices, if you take the S&P, for example, these yep. type of phenomena could not have sustained themselves for such a long time, because Teva came from such a much larger market cap compared proportionally to some of the other names, that even if it's down 40, 50%, it still basically captures a very significant disproportional, basically weighting okay. in the index.
So you end up with heavy weightings into certain stocks. What are the other issues around Israeli ETFs that you see?
I think the composition of the index is such that it needs to basically fit your outlook. For example, this year, the index was doing much better in the first part of the year due to the Russian invasion into Ukraine. If that fits your investment profile, that's great. But if it doesn't necessarily, because right. the composition is such that it has a fairly significant weightings of oil and gas,
yep.
fertilizers, defense.
All of which do well in a higher oil price environment. Yep.
So again, it's pretty thematic and it's not that dynamic. So okay. Obviously we manage a portfolio that should fit our investment outlook.
And which can change from time to time, yeah.
It does change from time, to say the least.
It's probably changed since the beginning of this conversation.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but as we speak, I'm basically trading.
Exactly. You keep looking at the other side of the screen. Okay. Yeah. Ron, that's really fabulous. Thank you. It's a great overview, both of the way you guys operate within Sphera and a little bit about the markets in which you're trading. So I really appreciate your wisdom and thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. That was my pleasure. Thank you very much, Darren. Appreciate
great.
It.
Okay. And to all the listeners out there, we'll keep more episodes coming up as we move on the Jewish holiday period. So look out and thanks very much for watching.